Life is a banquet, and most poor sons of bitches are starving to death.
Wow, just coming right out of the gate with it.
Hey, I mean, it's the defining quote, right? It's aggressive, it's definitely a little profane for the mid-60s, but it really sets the perfect table for what we are doing today.
It absolutely does. And for anyone listening who might not know that line, it is the core philosophy of the 1966 Broadway sensation MAME.
Exactly. Today we are taking a deep dive into MAME. We're looking at the Wikipedia entry, so we've got all the production logs, the chaotic casting history, the plot breakdowns, and the legacy. Our mission here is to really figure out how a story about this eccentric bohemian aunt became such a massive cultural phenomenon.
Right, because it's not just a recap of a fun story. We really want to unpack the mechanics of a smash hit.
Yeah.
How did the show bridge that gap between the Roaring Twenties and the counterculture movement of the 60s?
And honestly, the backstage drama might actually be better than the script itself.
Oh, without a doubt.
We're going to get into why the producers essentially said no to a literal Hollywood legend. And we also have the surprisingly dark origin of a Christmas song that you have absolutely heard playing in a shopping mall.
I love that we're covering that, because that specific detail completely flips the way you hear those lyrics.
It really does. But before we get to the music and the drama, we should probably set the stage with the source material. Because Maymay didn't just appear out of thin air in 1966.
No, by the time Jerry Herman and the writers, Lawrence and Lee, got to it, it was already a massive established franchise.
Right.
It started as a 1955 novel called Auntie Mame by Patrick Dennis, which, fun fact, Patrick Dennis was actually pseudonym for Edward Everett Danner III. And that book was just a juggernaut. It spent 112 weeks on the bestseller list.
112 weeks? That's more than 2 years.
Exactly. It was inescapable. And because it was so huge, it immediately became a straight stage play in 1956 and then a non-musical film in 1958 starring Rosalind Russell.
Right, Rosalind Russell, who basically was Maymay for an entire generation.
She defined the character. Mame Dennis, this wealthy, eccentric socialite living in Beekman Place in New York, who refuses to let reality crush her spirit.
So naturally, Broadway producers look at this property and they think, let's add songs.
That is the ultimate Broadway instinct. You have a larger-than-life character, huge emotional swings, exotic settings. It screams musical comedy.
But this is where the trouble really starts. Logically, you would assume they just call Rosalind Russell, right? Since she already played the role twice.
And she was the first call. But you have to remember, doing a musical is grueling. We're talking an 8-show week, the singing, the massive costume changes. Rosalind Russell just looked at that workload and turned it down flat.
She just didn't want this strain.
Right. So the producers move on. And Mary Martin actually accepted the role at first, but then she backed out. Ethel Merman declined it.
And then they start going down this wish list. I'm looking at the notes here, and it is practically a census of famous women from the 20th century.
It's staggering. Bette Davis, Doris Day, Katharine Hepburn.
Grace Kelly is on this list, which just feels so wrong.
I know. Grace Kelly is incredibly elegant, but Mame is a tornado. You need someone who has this chaotic, messy energy.
Yeah, someone who can fall off a prop moon and make it look funny, not, you know, tragic.
Exactly. But there is one name on this list that really stands out as the great tragedy of this whole production, Judy Garland.
Yes. This part is fascinating. Because Jerry Herman, the composer, he wasn't just casually interested in Judy Garland. He was obsessed with getting her.
He literally called hearing her sing a religious experience. He was writing the score with her voice. That's a specific tremulous vibrato in his head.
And she wanted the role too.
Desperately. She had seen the non-musical play, she knew the character, and she was really ready to make a major stage comeback.
So you have the star wanting it, the composer begging for her. Why didn't they cast her?
Corporate fear. You have to look at where Garland was in the mid-60s. She was struggling with addiction. She had just been fired from the film adaptation of Valley of the Dolls. To the producers, she wasn't this legendary entertainer anymore. She was an uninsurable liability.
It's just such a cold calculation.
It really is. They basically told Jerry Herman that they couldn't risk a multi-million-dollar show falling apart just because the star might not show up on opening night. Herman even tried to argue that a bad performance from Judy Garland would still be a historical event that people would pay to see.
Wow.
But the producers wouldn't budge.
It really marks a shift in Broadway, I think. Moving away from the star vehicle, where the star is the only thing that matters, to a more corporate model where reliability is your best asset.
That's a really great point. They chose safety over volatile genius. And to be fair to them, They struck gold anyway by pivoting to Angela Lansbury.
Which is wild because at the time, Angela Lansbury wasn't a musical comedy star. She was a character actress. She played villains. She was the terrifying mother in The Manchurian Candidate.
Right. She had done one musical, Anyone Can Whistle by Sondheim, but it was a commercial flop. But she auditions for Mamie, and she brings this perfect mix of warmth and steel. It just clicked. She opened at the Winter Garden Theater in May of 1966, and she became the definitive musical Mame.
And we definitely cannot ignore who she was sparring with on stage. Bea Arthur playing her best friend, Vera Charles.
Oh, the dynamic between Lansbury and Arthur is the engine of the entire show. Mamie is this eternal optimist, and Vera is the acerbic, drunk, cynical actress.
It's the classic bosom buddies dynamic, which actually is a great segue into the plot itself, because on the surface, Maymay kind of feels like a series of funny sketches, but there is a very specific philosophical conflict holding it all together.
Yes, the conflict between Mame's laboratory of life and the Babcock world.
Right, let's unpack that for the listeners. So Act One opens in New York City during the Roaring Twenties. Mamie is rich. She's throwing these wild parties, bathtub gin everywhere. And into this chaos walks her 10-year-old nephew, Patrick Dennis.
He's an orphan.
Hmm.
And Mamie immediately decides she is going to educate him, but not with traditional schooling. She wants to expose him to art, to eccentricity, to free thinking. She calls it the laboratory of life.
But there is an antagonist, Dwight Babcock, the conservative trustee of the boy's inheritance.
Babcock is the ultimate establishment figure. He's stuffy, conservative, obsessed with propriety. He just wants Patrick in a boarding school wearing a tie. This tug of war over Patrick's soul is really the spine of the first act.
And then the real villain of the story shows up, the economy.
The Wall Street crash of 1929. This is crucial context because Mamie isn't just a fluff piece. It is set against the Great Depression. The crash happens and Mamie's entire fortune is wiped out instantly.
Which sets up what I think is one of the funniest sequences. Mamie is broke and has to get a job.
And she has absolutely zero marketable skills.
None. So she tries acting. Her friend Vera gets her a tiny, tiny part in an operetta as the Man in the Moon.
A role where she has to sit on a crescent moon prop that gets hoisted up into the air.
And she destroys the production. She can't balance. The moon is swinging wildly. She almost falls into the orchestra pit. She completely ruins Vera's big musical number and gets fired immediately.
But this failure leads to romance. She tries being a manicurist next.
Where she is equally terrible. She meets this wealthy Southern gentleman named Beauregard Jackson Pickett Burnside.
The name alone is just a perfect caricature of Southern aristocracy.
Yeah, and she manicures his nails so aggressively that she actually makes his cuticles bleed. But he is charmed by her spirit, so he takes her down to his family plantation in Georgia, which is called Peckerwood.
And this brings in the classic fish-out-of-water comedy, May, the New York liberal bohemian, clashing with this rigid Southern aristocracy.
The family absolutely hates her, especially Beauregard's ex, Sally Cato. Sally tries to humiliate May by tricking her into riding in a dangerous fox hunt on a horse literally known as the Madman.
They fully expect Mame to get thrown off, maybe killed, or at least totally embarrassed.
But Mamie just clings on for dear life. The horse goes rogue, blows past the master of hounds, and Mamie accidentally wins the entire hunt. And the best part is she brings the fox back alive.
Which is such a great character moment. She's a humanist. She wouldn't let the fox get killed.
Exactly. This accidental triumph wins over the family. Beauregard proposes, and Act One ends with Mame wealthy again and happily married.
But if Act One is about Mamie conquering the world, Act Two is about her realizing she might have lost the war for Patrick's soul.
Yeah, we jump forward in time to World War II. Beauregard has passed away. He actually fell off an Alp in a mountaineering accident, which the show treats with this weirdly funny, dark humor.
Right. So Mamie is a widow, and Patrick is now a grown man. And the tragedy is that Patrick has turned into Dwight Babcock. He's become a bourgeois snob.
He is engaged to this girl named Gloria Upson. Hmm. And the Upsons live in what the notes refer to as a restricted community in Connecticut.
And we should definitely clarify what restricted means in this historical context. In the 50s and 60s, restricted was polite code for segregation. It meant no minorities, no Jewish people, just their kind of people.
The Upsons are bigoted, anti-Semitic, and just incredibly dull. They want Patrick to settle down into this very small, prejudiced life.
So Mamie has to execute one last laboratory of life lesson to save him. She invites the Upsons to her apartment for dinner.
And it is a scorched earth campaign. She serves flaming appetizers. She has all her most eccentric bohemian friends drop by. She basically forces these conservative snobs to see exactly the kind of world Patrick comes from.
And then she drops the absolute nuclear option. She reveals that she just bought the empty lot right next door to the Upson Estate in Connecticut
to build the Beauregard Burnside Memorial Home for Single Mothers.
It's brilliant. It's the ultimate spite move, but weaponized for social justice.
It works perfectly. The Upsons are horrified at the idea of unwed mothers living next door to them, so they storm out. Gloria dumps Patrick. And Patrick finally wakes up. He realizes he was about to trap himself in a hateful life, and he reconciles with Mame.
And the show ends with the cycle repeating years later, with Mame taking Patrick's young son off on adventures to India. It's a really beautifully structured story.
It is, but we really need to talk about the engine that drives all of this emotion. The score by Jerry Herman.
Herman claimed it only took him 6 months to write the score, which is insanely fast for Broadway. But he just knew exactly what this show needed to sound like.
And he produced a song that I think gives people the biggest aha moment when they hear about this show. We Need a Little Christmas.
It is a wild piece of musical theater trivia. Everyone knows this song. It's bouncy. It's joyful. You hear it in the mall starting November 1st.
Haul out the holly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the context of the song in the actual musical is incredibly grim.
Yeah, it happens right after the stock market crash in Act One. Mame has lost everything. They are completely broke. The servants aren't getting paid. Patrick is terrified. And it's not even December. It's early November.
She sings it not because it's the holidays, but because they are all deeply depressed. It's a song about psychological survival. She's basically saying reality is too painful right now, so we have to manufacture some joy immediately, or we are not going to survive this.
It changes the whole song. It's not a happy holiday tune. It's manic defiance.
Defiance through joy, which is a huge recurring theme for Jerry Herman. He did the exact same thing later in Le Casual Folle with the song I Am What I Am, insisting on your own happiness when the world wants you to be miserable.
The score also has If He Walked Into My Life, which is just a gut-wrenching ballad.
Edie Gourmet actually won a Grammy for her recording of that song. It's the moment in Act Two where Mame really questions her parenting. Did she give Patrick too much freedom? It grounds her so she isn't just a cartoon character.
And of course, there's the title track, Mame, which is this massive production number where the entire South serenades her. It's a total earworm.
Oh, it will be stuck in your head for days.
So the original production is a smash. Angela Lansbury wins the Tony for leading actress. Bea Arthur wins for featured actress. Frankie Michaels, the kid playing young Patrick, won featured actor. It was an unstoppable property.
Which naturally brings us to the inevitable disappointment, the 1974 film adaptation.
Starring Lucille Ball. Now look, I am a massive I Love Lucy fan. She is a comedy genius.
She's an absolute icon. But she was not May.
The reception for this movie was brutal. The source material frankly calls it a U.S. box office failure and a critical disappointment.
That's putting it politely. The critics completely eviscerated it. The main issue was the singing. Lucille Ball had a very low, gravelly, froggy voice. She just could not handle the vocal demands of Jerry Herman's score.
They had to drop the keys of the song significantly, and even then it just sounded rough.
And beyond the singing, she didn't really have that patrician elegance that Rosalind Russell or Angela Lansbury brought to it. Lucy was known for slapstick. She mugged for the camera. Mimi is eccentric, sure, but she's still an aristocrat. It was just a complete tonal mismatch. Even though Bea Arthur reprised her role as Vera for the film, it couldn't save it.
It really brings us back to that earlier point about casting for safety. The studio probably thought, Lucille Ball is the biggest star on television. She's bankable. Who cares if she can't sing? The name alone will sell tickets.
And it backfired completely. They passed on Judy Garland, a risky genius who would have sounded amazing, to protect their investment. Then years later, they hire a bankable star who couldn't do the job, and the investment failed anyway.
The ultimate irony of show business.
It really is. And sadly, that movie put a real damper on the show's legacy for a long time. Because for millions of people, that film was their only exposure to the character of Mame.
And the show has really struggled to find its footing on Broadway since then. There was a revival in 1983.
With Angela Lansbury reprising the role. You would think that would be a guaranteed slam dunk.
You have the original star, the original magic, but it closed after only 41 performances.
Which is shockingly short.
Why do you think that happened?
Timing, mostly. 1983 was the dawn of the mega musical era.
Yeah.
Cats had just opened. Les Miserables was right around the corner. Broadway was shifting into this massive spectacle industry. MAME is a very traditional book musical with the standard show tunes. It probably just felt like an antique to audiences then.
And it hasn't been back on Broadway since.
No, it hasn't. There have been tours, though. There was a Kennedy Center production in 2006 starring Christine Baranski.
Oh, I can totally see that. She has that perfect mix of haughty and fun.
She was excellent. And recently, in 2019, there was a UK production starring Tracy Bennett, which was actually the first UK staging in 50 years. So the show isn't dead. It just hibernates. It waits for the right star.
It is a star vehicle in the truest sense of the phrase. You cannot just plug anyone into that role. You need a performer who can be hilarious, break your heart, and belt to the back row.
And someone who truly embodies the philosophy we started this whole conversation with.
Life is a banquet.
Exactly. When you strip away the costumes and the big staircases, Mommy is a story about pure resilience. Think about the era it depicts. The Depression, the lead up to World War II. The world was a terrifying place.
But Mamie chooses to engage with the world rather than hide from it.
She opens a new window, to quote another great song from the show. Whether she is fighting a conservative trustee, getting fired from a job she's terrible at, or standing up to bigotry in the Connecticut suburbs, she never retreats. She is always moving forward.
I think that is why it still resonates so much, even if the movie was a dud. That message of saying yes to life, even when life is actively saying no to you, that's completely timeless.
And doing it with style.
Always with style. Listen, before we wrap up today, I want to leave everyone with one final thought about that casting drama we discussed. The Garland versus Ball situation.
The great what-if scenario.
Yeah. It really makes you wonder about the nature of risk in art. The producers tried to eliminate risk by banning Judy Garland, but in doing so, they might have robbed us of a definitive, recorded performance that could have stood the test of time forever.
Instead, we got the safe movie that nobody wants to watch.
Exactly.
It suggests that in creative endeavors, playing it safe is often the most dangerous path you can take. Sometimes you just have to bet on the volatile genius.
That is a perfect point to end on. If you are listening and you haven't heard the original Broadway cast recording with Angela Lansbury, go find it right now. Skip the movie. Trust us on that one.
And haul out the holly, whatever time of year it happens to be.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We will see you on the next Deep Dive.